Welcome to Confessions of an Entrepreneur, powered by RG. My name is Carl Swansbury, and I'm absolutely thrilled today to welcome Andy Preston onto my podcast. I've known Andy Preston, like I'm sure many of our viewers have done, for a decade or two, as a consequence of him being a very high-profile businessman, investor, and someone who does an awful lot for the Northeast from a charitable perspective. But actually, despite knowing of Andy, and despite having met Andy multiple times over the years, I actually have never had the opportunity to sit down with Andy to find out more about his upbringing, his why, the things that inspires and motivates him today as a businessman doing great for great causes locally. So I'm really looking forward to getting under the skin of Andy Preston, to finding out more about Andy and the things that are important to him. Andy, can I just start by first of all saying how thrilled I am to have you on my Confessions of an Entrepreneur's podcast. I've known you for more than a decade, but actually I've never had the chance to really get to know you. So I'm really thrilled today to spend a little time in your company.
Great to be here. Looking forward to it. Let's see what you're going to ask me.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to start right back at the beginning, Andy, because I know, of course, many of our guests and many of our viewers will know that you are someone who's highly committed to Teesside, but perhaps won't know why. So I'd love to go right back to the beginning. So just tell me a little bit more about where you were brought up, please, Andy.
So I was brought up in Middlesbrough, lived in various places across town. What can I tell you about my family? When I was born, we lived in a place called Linthorpe. My dad was a joiner. My mother at that time was a barmaid in the local pub, the Yellow Rose, which some people will know, perhaps, who watch this. And then over time, you know, my dad studied, he went to night school, he became a teacher. And I think that actually tells you something about the family ethos. There was a kind of sense of wanting to improve your life. I wouldn't say better yourself, because a teacher isn't better than a joiner, but perhaps you might have a better life in terms of perhaps you earn more money, perhaps you'd have a better something or other. And I think that's a little bit, in a small way, that was part of the ethos of the family, was that you should work hard and you should be the best person you can be.
Yes, totally. That makes sense. And how many siblings did you have?
So I am the oldest of four. We lost one of my brothers, Johnny, 4 years ago. But we are still three, very close. We all muck on, get on with stuff. And we're kind of different but similar.
And when you say similar, is it the work ethic? Is it the values that you have in common?
Definitely, me and my sister are very similar, that we're very energetic. We're always doing stuff. She's more so than me. She just has this energy and passion for doing more and helping more people and usually saying yes to requests for help and things like that. Whereas I'm a little bit older and perhaps got used to saying no and valuing my time. And that came to me with age, actually. When I was younger, I would do everything. And I think I'm a lot healthier and happier now I say no. But I'm getting off the point. My point was, my sister and I are very similar. My brother, Chris, is similar but a bit different, a bit more laid back, a bit more level-headed, a bit more work-life balance.
Okay.
Chris and I have done business together, bits in property, little bits of investing. And we're similar but different. Chris is quite a lot younger. I was the oldest of four, and there's 8 years between me and Chris.
Okay.
So that's quite a lot. So when I'm like 15 and looking to start going to pubs and stuff, if I can, he was like seven.
That's right.
Yeah. So he's still a little kid, you know? So we were very different age groups. He was almost, as a big brother, I was almost like an uncle or something, I guess. But now, the 8 years between us doesn't matter so much.
No.
And we're kind of the same age.
Yeah. And of course, you've got a big birthday next year, right?
Which will talk
a little
about it.
Well, I'm not saying anything. I said big birthday.
It is a big birthday. I'm going to be 60 next year.
Well, you said it, you see.
And I was thinking about this. And you know what? For a long time, I was really scared of getting older. I remember a period when I was about 40, 41. And I used to really fret about getting older. And at 40, 41, I used to think, oh my word, I'm probably I might be halfway through my life now.
Mm.
Oh, what's it amounted to? Have I done enough? Do I need to do more? What do I do? I'm panicking. And actually, now I am completely happy. I'm fit. I'm strong. I am lively. And I feel fantastic. So as things stand today, I am not remotely scared of being 5 years or 10 years older. Not remotely. But there was a period in my life where I was a bit scared.
Mm.
And I'm not. I feel more energetic, more determined in some ways than I was when I was 40.
Yes. And we'll definitely talk about some of the things you've pointed to there later in the podcast, Andy. But one direct question now. So as you say, you now don't feel anxious anymore about the fact that perhaps, you know, you are becoming more mature in years. And we all acknowledge that, you know, we only have limited time on this earth. What is it that has gave you that contentment? Why do you feel less anxious now?
So I'm definitely not content. I am the least content person in the world. I'm always trying to do this or do that. And I'm always frustrated and getting anxious about things. I'm certainly not content. But what I was trying to explain was that I am not as worried or I'm not worried about being 5 years or 10 years older, because I think I'm broadly as fit as I was when I was 40. I'm probably as brave. I'm a bit wiser, but I do probably as much. Mm. So I'm not scared of being a bit older, which I think I was when I was 40.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
It does make sense. Yeah. It does.
Yeah. I'm not content. I'm just not as worried about getting older.
Mm. And I'd love to understand why you seem to view the word contentment negatively. And by that, I mean, I use the word content there, Andy, and you were very quick and totally respectfully to dismiss the fact that you are content. What is wrong with being content?
Yeah, there's nothing. It's great to be content. And do you know what? If someone is happy with their lot.
Yes.
That's literally all you can ask for, right?
Yes.
If you are happy in your life, that is all you can ask for.
Absolutely.
I'm not. I never have been, and I don't think I ever will be. It's just not me. I've had some failures in my life. I've had some successes, and some of my successes have been material.
Mm-hmm.
And to some people, some of the material successes are significant. And they would say, oh, my word, look at that house you live in or whatever, and how does it feel when you drive up that drive? And I'm like, what, you think I'm like feeling great? No, I'm worried about tomorrow and I'm terrified of what happens next year. What if I'm doing this and it doesn't work? And
yes,
how do I make that happen? I strive for things, and if I get them, I don't celebrate. I'm thinking, okay, fine, what's next?
Yes,
what's
interesting.
Next?
Interesting.
Okay. So that's actually probably means I'll never be content.
Mm.
But I wouldn't be content just sitting at home and thinking, oh, this is fine. I'll be happy and calm.
Yes.
It's just not me. I need to do stuff.
Yes.
I really need to do stuff.
That makes total sense. Yeah. And we'll definitely come back to this a little later.
Yeah.
Because one of my mentors from the past actually spent a lot of time trying to get me to appreciate the difference between being inspired and being content. Mm-hmm. And the two things are different. Mm-hmm. So I'm continually inspired. Mm-hmm. I always have to be doing something that takes me out of my comfort zone, but I'm also incredibly content.
Yeah.
So it's quite an interesting conundrum, is that?
That's interesting. Yeah.
Indeed. So, of course, you were saying that it was yourself along with your three siblings who were brought up by a very hardworking family. Just tell me a bit more now about your education and the choices you made, please, Andy, if you don't mind.
So I went to, you know, the nearest Catholic schools, and I didn't like school. Most people look back, or many look back and say how it was great. I didn't like it. And I don't look back and think, oh, actually, it was great.
Right.
I didn't like it at all.
Why is that, do you think?
I never felt happy. Exactly why I never felt happy, I'm not certain. It might be because I don't like being part of a group that is kind of told what to do.
Right, okay.
I just don't. I just rail against that. I have an issue with conforming.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds terrible, doesn't it? But I just do. I'm just made that way.
Yes.
When I go on a building site and they say you have to put a high vis on, if they literally force me to, I will. But as soon as they're not looking, I take it off.
Right.
I can't bring myself to wear a lanyard.
Yeah.
I can't do what's expected.
Yes. Okay.
The only things I've done really well in my life are when I do the unexpected.
Yes.
So someone was talking the other day about politics and about politicians, and it was actually talking about Rishi Sunak, who I think is a great person, and I think a really intelligent man who wants to do the right thing. And I'm saying that Rishi Sunak is a perfect head boy material for a school. And I believe he was head boy.
He was indeed.
And he's perfect because Rishi Sunak will always do the right thing according to what that organization believes is the right thing. He will do what's exactly what's expected and predicted. And I'm the opposite. Like in the school, I wasn't the kid who set fire at the science block. But I was naughty. And I was rebellious. And I was a bit... which is partly because I now know I have ADHD, which makes me very restless and hard to manage. And talking of ADHD, I've forgotten what the question was.
So we were talking about why perhaps you didn't love school.
So I just didn't. I didn't enjoy it. I don't like being told what to do.
Yep.
Unless the person's an expert.
Yes.
So if I got the doctors, I want a doctor who's really telling me what to do.
Yep.
If the doctor's certain, I don't want them to like say, "Oh, you might want to think about." I want the doctor to say, "Listen, do X, Y, Z, or this will happen." I want this to be black and white. If I don't perceive someone as an expert, I don't feel comfortable following and joining in. I like being part of a gang, but on my own terms.
Yes. Which is quite interesting. And sorry to interrupt you, Andy, but perhaps that's something that a lot of politicians get wrong. And by that, I mean, I don't think many politicians now are seen as experts, which is why people don't follow.
Yeah.
So actually, there's a lot in what you said there around why people do not follow politicians.
I think what I've learned actually as I got older, Carl, I do now appreciate that some people are given a role where they have to be the one who sets the rules and tells you what to do.
Yes.
And that person has to be defined.
Yep.
And if you want to be part of the group, you have to follow it. And sometimes for your own safety, you have to follow it.
Mm.
And I've reconciled that in my head. So I do follow now in that situation, but I naturally just don't. I've never had a hero. I've never had posters on my wall of someone. I've just never really been someone that naturally falls in behind another.
Yes, interesting.
It is interesting. And I think sometimes that's been to my benefit, sometimes to my detriment.
When has it been to your detriment?
I think at school. I think in various situations in my life, I've perhaps not been offered things that I was probably very capable of doing because I wasn't the kind of person they could rely on to follow the letter of their law.
Right, yes.
I might have the same objective.
Yes.
And I think people can see that in me very well. There was someone recently I wanted to hear and I was talking to them. It was a political situation. I won't talk about that. But I'm not a maverick, but I think that some people can see that I'm not head boy material.
Yes.
And I never will be.
No.
Yeah.
And you know what? I think there's something really, really inspiring and also endearing in just being able to acknowledge that.
Yeah.
It demonstrates huge self-awareness on your part.
Yeah.
And like you, I would never be good head boy material because I'd do the right thing, but I won't be told to do something if I don't think it's the right thing to do.
Absolutely.
Sometimes process and procedure isn't there to help one win. It's there to slow folk down.
Sure.
And I suspect you and I will be
to make manageable. Absolutely. Totally.
Okay. Totally. So obviously you left school and were elated by the sounds of it. So what came next for you as a young boy finding his feet in this big, bad world?
So in this big, bad world, I left school in 1982. I was 15, coming up 16. Almost no qualifications. Wasn't good at school at all. I joined the Air Force. There were no jobs around. There's a big industrial recession then. And it hit places like the Northeast Windy really hard.
Mm.
And big employers like, I don't know, shipbuilders and steelworks that would have employed 5 years earlier, hundreds or even thousands of people a year as apprentices,
it's gone.
It went overnight. As a 16-year-old, you don't take it that seriously. But I think looking back, it was very grim.
Mm.
I joined the Air Force, did that. I had a lot of fun.
Mm.
Did a lot of sport, did some incredible things. again, had some personal issues falling in and following. Yeah. But the rules were strict. I managed to do it, but it wasn't for me. But it was a great way of getting me. I needed to get out of my environment and I needed to be the person that I wanted to be. Yeah. See, when you're at school, you are under pressure all the time. You're trying to impress some people and I don't know, perhaps be seen to be tough on other people. It's a pressure cooker.
Mm. Yeah, it is.
Trying to save face, win favor. Yeah. And I didn't like that. I really didn't like that. And that shapes your personality into something that gets through it. If that makes sense.
It does.
So for me, getting away from all of that, I could become the person that I wanted to be.
And how do you think you could achieve that, though, by joining the RAF? Because, of course, in that environment, yep, there's lots of stakeholders. Mm-hmm. Of course, you are trying to impress, otherwise you're out. Mm-hmm. So talk to me how you felt that changed.
The industry did that to me, but it was getting away from that environment of school,
okay,
and hanging out with my school friends,
right,
and being known by everyone. Because people make assumptions about you and expect you to behave a certain way.
Based on association.
You had though. The reason you may have behaved that way was because of them.
Yes.
Not blaming them, but what I'm saying is you fitted in with the crowd.
Yes, understand.
And so it's really healthy to get away and decide who, find out who you are, what do you want to do? And that's what I did. And I decided that I wanted to do something big. Didn't know what. I wanted to make money. I don't know, do exciting things.
Yes.
So I thought, right, the simplest way, this was the 80s, right? So the simplest way that I could see was getting involved with financial markets. That's what ambitious young men in London seem to be doing, seem to be making huge amounts of money. And I thought, I'm sure I could do that. I'm sure I'd be at least as good as them. So I went to university. I went to night school, went to university. I went to Edinburgh University. And then I left there and eventually got a job as a trainee at a stockbroking firm, and then worked my way up from graduate trainee and ended up different places as a managing director. And the last thing I did was I used to build and run trading businesses and a hedge fund for a bank. And that was great. That was incredible, exhilarating, exciting, rewarding, successful, and a lot of the time, and not successful some of the time. And it was an incredible experience. Incredible.
And you've just summarized there in sort of 30 seconds, Andy, you know, a decade plus of your life. So just two quick questions. So when you left Edinburgh University, did you know that you were going to become a trader or involved in financial services? Was that the logical next step?
That was my goal.
Okay.
And that was really tough.
Of course. And was that the reason you went to university, i.e. that was a means to an end?
Yes, not quite as prescriptive of that, but that was a goal. Yes. A goal was to study, so I was a graduate, so I could get a greatly increased chance of a much better job. And so that's why I went. And then, as I say, this was the 80s, late 80s, and the exciting career, the whole yuppie thing was an 80s thing. It was all about money, careers, success, and I wanted that. I saw that and I wanted that. You know, we grew up without any money really at home. We sort of got by, we weren't desperately poor, but there was no money, and I always wanted money. I always worked for money, I always did jobs, I always had paper around, I always cut neighbors' gardens, I always wanted money. I used to spend it, I never saved it, I used to spend it, but I wanted to be able to have money to spend.
Cool.
And so that was a real motivator for me. So working in the city, in trading, was brilliant. It was absolutely, it was everything I dreamed of. It took a long time to get in, but when I got in, it worked out perfectly.
Mm. And presumably living in London as a trader was quite different to living in Teesside. Just talk to me about how you re-climatized, because chalk and cheese are the two examples there.
Yeah, it was a different life. Of course it was. I wouldn't say one was better or worse. Let me give you an example. I'm trying to think. So for periods of my career, there was a period actually, in fact, where I used to go to New York. I'd fly out there every Sunday night. I think it was the VS-17, the Virgin flight, and this car would come pick me up and take me the Virgin lounge at Heathrow, and then I'd fly off and land in Newark, I think. Anyway, I'd get to my hotel about sort of like 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock their time, and then I'd be in the office there in New York for I don't know. This was just after, is it actually just after 9/11?
Right, okay.
Obviously a horrific event that impacted New York in particular horribly. And one of the impacts of that was made New York, Manhattan, and the hotels are really quiet.
Yes.
And the flights were quiet.
Yep.
So as a traveler, that was actually a much more enjoyable time to travel.
Mm.
And I was traveling in that era. It was remarkable. Sometimes I'd travel across the U.S. And that was strange because I'd always get picked out for security. Airport security was tightened, as you imagine. And I'd be at, I don't know, I'm trying to think, like Cleveland or something, right? Some like regional airport hub. And we'd all be queuing up to get on the flight to Washington or somewhere. And they could say, excuse me, sir, I see your passport. Yeah, just a random security check. Could you? But it wasn't random. Of course it wasn't. They always, always, always picked me because I was the only non-American on that particular flight. It was a strange time. But the life then was, yeah, I was a lot of time in New York, a lot of entertaining, a lot of, I suppose, high living in that sense.
So,
but you know what? I mean, people sometimes think it's like a different world and it kind of can look like that. But then 2 days later, I'm in the queue at Tesco's, you know, and I'm working out whether to buy that rice or that rice. And I'm working out, is that one per 100 grams 5p cheaper? You know, I'm walking to the tube. You know, people often think that your life becomes very insulated. I think where I've been lucky in my life, it's removed a stress about money. I don't have to worry.
Yeah.
In the same, I still worry about money, but I don't have to worry about whether I can afford to fix my car. I don't have to worry about whether I can pay to get the roof. I still fret a bit about money, but my life is still very similar.
Yes.
You know, I'm still queuing up now and then at McDonald's, right? I'm still, I don't know, going in the shop to buy, I don't know, whatever. I'm still living a normal life. I'm doing pretty much everything that everybody else does. And I always did, even when I was running hedge funds. But there was another dimension of stuff that perhaps most people don't see.
Yes.
But I don't think it was, I was still the same person because I was still the same person queuing up at Tesco.
Yes. And on that, how did you make sure that you could still relate to your friends and family in Teesside who still had some of the money worries that you had thankfully distanced yourself from?
Well,
how do you keep relative?
I don't think I deliberately came up with. I think sometimes I did forget and I'd talk to people and forget that they have a different set of worries. Sometimes.
Yes.
But I was with a friend the other week. I hadn't seen him for 10 years. He's in London. He was a banker. And he said the first time he knew I was a bit different to some of the others that in our gang, because we were at this private club, I think it's called Home House. And it got to about 11 o'clock one Thursday night. And I'm probably going to go home now. I've got a busy day at work tomorrow. And I said, it is quite funny, but it seemed normal at the time. And I said to the person, the receptionist at this private club, I said, is there a bus to Islington around that goes from outside here? And everyone just thought it was the most bizarre thing. And it is pretty bizarre, actually, because nobody who ever goes there would worry about getting the bus home.
They'd have a driver, presumably.
They'd have a driver or or have someone hail them a taxi.
Yes.
And he laughed and I laughed. That's always been my mindset. I hate spending more money than I need to. I do enjoy some of the finer things, but I will literally, if I'm up with my boys, and we're in the high street, and they're saying, should we go to Costa and tuna melt? I'm like, yeah. And then I go, no, let's go home and make a coffee and I'll make you a tuna sandwich and we'll save like £7 each.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
And that's not me trying to instill something in them. That's just me. I don't like to waste money.
Yeah, you want a wasteful person.
I'll spend it if it's special. If it's a really great experience.
Yes.
Does that answer the question?
It does. It does. It absolutely does.
Yeah.
And I think not being wasteful definitely will be as a consequence of, as a young boy, you appreciating how hard your parents were working to give you the simple things in life. So I suspect that stayed
maybe
true, right?
I don't know where it comes from. I don't know. Maybe I'm tight. I don't know. I'm pretty careful with money.
Yes.
Yeah, I'm pretty careful with money.
Yeah, I do.
Enjoy good things.
You know, if you count the pennies, the pounds look after themselves, right?
Somewhat. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I think so.
Okay. So is it safe for me to assume, Andy, that when you were, you know, working a full-on life as a hedge fund, you were focused fully on capitalism? Is that right? Were you at that stage fully focused on creating financial independence? Is that what motivated
you? Yeah, I was focused on trying to get paid a lot of money.
Yes.
So that was my mission. I was in that zone. I wanted to earn as much as I possibly could, as quickly as possible.
Yes.
And that meant that I was trying to make as much money for the business,
yeah,
because I got a share of that.
Sure.
So I was completely and utterly 100% focused on that. Yeah.
And did there become a time where you realized that perhaps you were having to sacrifice things that were important to you in pursuit of this financial independence?
No.
No, so you were, well, often people who've achieved a lot professionally talk about not seeing their family, their friends,
not doing the things they enjoy,
because of course they're putting 24 hours a day into their career. Did you ever feel?
Yeah, look, I've had niggles from family over the years.
Yes.
My wife in particular, that, you know, you're never present.
Yeah.
You're on your phone. We've gone to, I don't know, safari, and you're on the phone and all of this stuff. I think that's just who I am. And it may be a symptom of my ADHD that I can be with someone and doing stuff, but I'm frequently, my mind's racing to other things too.
Right. Okay.
But did I make real sacrifices professionally? It was a pleasure and a privilege to get the chance to do that.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, that's a mindset.
I worked long hours.
Yes.
But it was a pleasure and privilege.
But that is a mindset thing, isn't it, right? So you chose to see it as a pleasure and a privilege versus a chore and hard work.
Yeah.
And that is a choice. And I speak a lot about mindset because it's fascinating. You can give one person a set of circumstances and they can only rise to the occasion because it's an opportunity. Mm-hmm. You can give that same set of circumstances to somebody else, and it's a chore, it's a burden, it's frustrating.
Yeah.
And the only difference is mindset each time. So I thought the respect you chose to see that is a real huge opportunity for Andy.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, got it, thank you. So tell me what it was that therefore started to encourage you to think about a change in direction.
So when I was involved running hedge funds, a guy approached me, a very wealthy, flamboyant financier, this sort of French guy, very, how would I describe him without telling you who he is? I mean, people on podcasts probably wouldn't know who he is, but they Google him and lots of stuff would come up. But a really flamboyant character. The first time I met him, he came to our office because he was thinking of investing in the hedge fund.
Right.
This was probably about 2002, 2003. No one was allowed to smoke in offices then, right? No one. Anywhere in office. And he came in, and this guy was incredibly charismatic, sort of playboy-type guy with hair swept back, French. Sat in the office, and we're talking, and he gets this packet of Marlboro. He sort of looks at me, and he taps the cigarette, puts his mouth, lights it, blows the smoke out. And then just carried on. And he did it so brazenly. And because I wanted him to put some money in.
That's right.
I wanted some of him in. I thought, I didn't feel like I could or should say something. Interestingly, looking back 20 odd years later, I think perhaps it was a test.
Mm.
Perhaps he was waiting to see whether I was the kind of guy to say, put that out. Put that out, you bastard. How dare you? But I wanted something from him. And he did it so with such bizarre confidence. And he was a bizarrely confident man. And I could tell you all kinds of interesting things about him.
No, I think I've got a sort of flavor for who he is, for sure.
Right. Anyway, so, to answer your question, this flamboyant financier approached me sometime later or got somewhere else to do on his behalf. And asked if I wanted to become a patron of a charity. And this charity was a philanthropic group. And it approached people that were earning lots of money and asked them to give an amount of money each year for 3 years, a minimum of 3 years. It was a minimum of £10,000. People typically gave more. I mean, some people would get £1 million.
Yes.
I don't know, varying amounts. That was the absolute minimum. And basically that money was gathered together, and it was used to do incredible work all around the world. It bought anti-AIDS drugs. When anti-AIDS drugs were still under patent, they were extraordinarily expensive. So they would buy anti-AIDS drugs and distribute them with all official organizations across sub-Saharan Africa, parts of Thailand. It worked hard and closed down dodgy orphanages in a place like India, but built a new one and staffed it and ran it properly. And I got involved with that, and it felt like a privilege to be asked. I'd grown up with a charitable mindset. That was our family's approach to stuff. But suddenly being asked to write a big check, even though I had the money, it was something I'd never seen or thought about.
Yeah.
So I did, and it felt great. And I got involved with this group, and it felt really great. And they said to me when I joined, do you want publicity from this? And I thought, well, I suppose selfishly, perhaps I do, actually. I'd like people to know that I'm part of this gang, you know, that I'm part of this group that does good stuff. But I was brought up never to talk about money that you give.
Right.
So I explained, you know what, I'm not sure it's the right thing because I don't think it's right to publicize that you're giving money. And they said, well, actually, the thing is, if we can tell people that you've given money, then people you know might be more inspired or shamed into giving money too.
Yes.
So I said, okay, let's do it. So that was the business model. It went to people who had money, and it broadcast the fact they'd given. And I also said that when I came back up north, I'd do something similar, Carl.
Right.
So I did. So I formed a charity with a lot that I gave it a long name called the Middlesbrough and Teesside Philanthropic Foundation. And I went to 40-odd businesses in 2010 or something. And I basically said, oh, well then, you're doing okay. Will you put some money in this pot? And we will support community groups across where we all do business. And of the 40, I think about 31 said yes.
Wow.
Gave incredible. £5,000. Some gave more.
Yep.
I was a donor too. And that charity now has been going for, I don't know, 14 years or something like that. And it's raised about £6 million and it's growing really strong. So that's great.
That's incredible. I mean, just to pause, that is incredible.
Yeah.
And of course, that £6 million has been invested and deployed in Teesside, right?
Yeah, just it raised the money into Teesside.
Which is incredible, Andy. So congratulations.
It's created apprenticeships. Yeah. It's done incredible things with sports groups, looked after kids. It's great.
Yeah, the number of lives that charity has transformed is just incredible. So congratulations.
Thank you. No, that's great. So that was my segue into formally being involved with charities came through this financier guy who wanted smoked in the office when it's clearly forbidden. Interesting guy. Yeah. And then from there, I set up another charity, which you know about.
Indeed.
And you did the first official CEO sleep out.
Correct. Indeed.
St. James Park.
That's right, which was incredible, despite the venue. Of course, as a Sunderland fan, I must admit, I did feel slightly anxious walking onto the fallow turf at St. James's Park, but for charity.
Well, I've got
something I was willing to do.
A photograph of you sat in the press desk.
Gosh.
In the stadium with your Sunderland scarf. Mm. That was a mate of yours. I can't remember who.
That's right. It was Andy Woodhouse.
That was Andy Woodhouse.
That's right. Good friend.
I've got a photograph of that somewhere. So then that, and CEO Sleepout has gone similarly well. From humble beginnings, that's puts on about 15 events a year.
And that's national now.
National. I've done at Wembley Stadium.
Yeah, it's incredible.
All sorts. Incredible. And that's raised over $6 million too.
Wow.
So that's fantastic. Yeah.
It's incredible.
Incredible.
So obviously the flamboyant financier who you met in your hedge fund office, who was smoking inappropriately, he is the person who inspired you to start thinking about how you can do things for greater good.
Yes.
And of course, you've kindly talked about certain charities that you've set up since and support to this day. When did you decide to walk away from running a hedge fund? When did you decide that part of your career was done?
So I walked away in the end of 2005, and it had been an absolute roller coaster 4 years. Incredible. I never had a projection or a target in mind, but it exceeded anything I could have feasibly set.
Yes,
in many ways, it was just barnstorming, raised just billions, and the performance was great. Performance tailed off in the end. I was I was always asking, saying to the bank that I wanted more money.
Yep.
I was quite difficult in that sense. Actually, looking back, too difficult. But while we were making lots of money for the bank pretty much said yes to everything.
Yep.
And then as soon as it got a bit more difficult, I mean, we weren't making so much money for the bank or even any, I wasn't tolerated. My demands weren't tolerated quite as readily. So it was difficult to lead because I was thinking of setting up my own business.
Yes.
And they were very understandably anxious about that because even if I hadn't deliberately gone and poached clients, many were relationships of mine.
Yes.
That might have been very interested in coming with me. So there was a lockout period. And we got around that. And I did start a business with a friend doing similar stuff in 2000 and end of, was it end of 2000? Must have been 2000s, end of 2006. And we started with $50 million of capital from a big European bank and another hedge fund. And we started working with that. I put a little bit of money in. And gradually, what happens is you gradually get more investors to come in. And they were coming in, I think, over about 6 months, we got up to about 120 million, which is your kind of critical point. And then it starts to snowball. As long as you keep that performance going.
Yes.
And the performance was going just about right, kind of doing that 1% a month-ish return to investors. It was all going swimmingly. And then the financial crisis started to happen. So the financial crisis that gripped the whole world in 2008 started to severely impact what we did in 2007. It just became horrendous. So we started to backtrack. Investors started to pull some money out, go to less risky things and reallocate money there. So in 2008, we started to unwind the fund. So we couldn't continue. So we started that closer down 2008. By that time, my wife had been living up north for several years.
Right, okay.
And I was moving between London and North Yorkshire.
Yeah.
That was the time I thought, you know what, let's ditch that. So I ditched in 2005 with a plan that I might come back and do something on my own.
Mm-hmm.
And then started on my own with a friend, and it's going actually well, everything's going exactly as we would predict. And then the financial crisis started to unfold 2007 and made what we did really impossible to.
Yes. So in 2008, as you say, you decided that perhaps, you know, it was the right time to pause professionally. Mm-hmm. You wound up your own hedge fund mm-hmm. and returned to the Northeast to be with family.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. At that time, did you have in your mind clarity as to what you wanted to do next? You know, was there a plan in mind? Or actually, did you say, you know what, I'm just going to pause, spend some time with family, then see what lands?
Yeah, I didn't have a plan. I almost never have like a firm plan. I've never had a life plan. I've had things that I want that. I want to do that. But I've never been one of these people that said, oh, age 23, I do this and this is how I do it. I've never had it written down. I've never had that. And yeah, I didn't have a goal. But what happened was 2008, I was home. The world's falling apart financially. 2009, I start seeing that commercial property, office buildings, things like that are empty. The prices have halved. Sometimes they've gone down 75%. Excuse me. So I started to buy office buildings and other bits of property here and there. And carried on buying until about 2012.
Okay.
And then 2017, 18 onwards, started to slowly sell some of that. So I made some okay money doing that.
And you were doing that individually?
Usually on my own. Sometimes with my brother. Sometimes with my friend and sometimes with a couple of other partners.
Okay, understand. And say for those property transactions, Andy, were you therefore spending a lot more time at home, not traveling as much, presumably, if that was all in Teesside?
All around the Northeast.
Yeah, great.
So one of the buildings I bought over near Bolden, some office buildings near Bolden, I'm going over there next. I bought those in about 2010, I think. And they were all empty and unloved, and we improved them and got them let.
Awesome.
I'm going over. We might do some work. So I'm going over to have a look at that. Huh? I don't like property. I don't like owning property. I'm scaling out. I don't have huge amounts, but I want to do other things. What I have been focused on, you didn't ask me this, but I'm going to. What I have been focused on for the last year or so is private investing.
Yep.
Newish, startup-ish kind of businesses, EIS, SEIS. I've done quite a lot of that and plan to do some more of that over the next 2 years.
Where you will be investing in high growth, small businesses.
Largely software related.
Understand. And when you were investing, Andy, obviously you're investing for a financial return, naturally. Are you providing your expertise, your input, your time as well to help these businesses scale? Or is it more as an investor?
Some groups have suggested they might want me to,
yes,
to help, but I'm not sure I could add any value to them at all.
So this is a financial
investment. This is a pure financial investment. I'm looking for, if I make 50 investments, I'm looking for, I would expect that 40 over 5 to 10 years, 40 go bust,
okay,
a few break even, and a handful do well, and one of them does really well.
That's right, one unicorn.
And then I'll average a 15% return annualized on the hold up.
Yes. And why are you doing that now?
Why am I doing that? I'm doing it because I think actually it's a better way for me to make money. I think it's simpler, it's cleaner, there's less to worry about. I get updates and there are some tax incentives to do it. The government is desperate for more people to invest in private businesses. The record in the UK is actually pretty good. Outside of the USA and China, for tech investing, the UK is the third biggest place in the world. But we need more. We need more people investing. We need more businesses started. And I love being part of that. But I'm doing it to make money. And so far, and I've been doing it for 10 years, so far, yeah, I've made money, but most go bust. And some do okay, and you get one or two does really, really well. And overall, you make your compound 15% on all of them, plus some tax breaks.
Yes. And you mentioned that you think it's a better way of making money. Were you meaning in comparison to property?
Yeah, property's a hassle. It's brought with risk. I think the world is changing. I still believe that people will use offices. People have said that they're not going to be... In the middle of the COVID pandemic, people thought that offices were over. And I never believed a word of it. I always thought people will go back to the office. Offices will exist, but they'll exist in a different ways.
Yes.
There'll be less demand, in my opinion, than there was pre-pandemic. But I think that we're likely to see over 20, 30 years, the beginning of population decline. I think that less demand for property. I think that residential property will probably start to fall in value nationally, with certain exceptions. I think prime areas in the biggest cities will likely do okay. But peripheral locations and cities will struggle as population declines. We've already got examples of population decline in places like Italy and Japan. The rural places have struggled most, places without the infrastructure. Young people and people with families tend to move more towards the cities where there are the schools,
the infrastructure.
Yeah. And as more people leave the smaller towns and cities, there's even less reason to maintain a hospital there.
Absolutely right.
So that's what's likely to unfold, unless we get a pickup in birth rate. That's what's likely to unfold in the UK. So I wouldn't want to be buying residential property anywhere but prime London at the moment.
Yep.
Even then, I don't think it's the same bet that it was. So I see property as full of hassle. Returns are okay long-term in the past, but looking forward, I would say property is infinitely more uncertain and unlikely to produce great returns. I'm going into other things.
Well, it's a fascinating analysis, Andy, to hear. And whilst a lot of viewers might still believe residential and commercial property are good investments, actually, for the reasons you've highlighted, and of course, the tax changes coming down the track, that's just continually proving to be less the case, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, now in the Northeast, residential property yields are 10%.
Yeah.
And I think only going one way. So I do think it's a good question you posed.
See, people think property is great, but you don't really make money as a buy-to-let landlord, from what I can see, anymore, right? Once you have maintained a property, it's empty sometimes, then you pay your tax. You don't make any money. But people have kept doing it because in recent years, prices have gone up.
That's right.
Once that stops, which it has now in many places, and once it starts to reverse, the landlords, some will want to get out and some will be forced to get out by their lenders. And forgive me if this is too pessimistic, but I wouldn't be investing in residential property right now. It's probably fine for 5 to 10 years.
Mm.
But once population
decline, yes, you're talking longer term, aren't you, Andy? Yes.
Longer term.
So Andy, obviously we've talked there about your assessment of the property sector when it comes to returns longer term. And you've explained that you're now looking to invest in more businesses to try and not only benefit from the tax incentives, but also to generate material capital return as some of these businesses scale and succeed. Whilst you won't be looking to be actively involved in the businesses you're investing in, what is it you look for when deciding whether to invest?
Okay, so I've invested in lots so far, and I think that instead of me choosing them, I would have been as good throwing darts on a board. Yeah, okay. I think that the overall return I've got from investing in, say, 50 businesses has been about what a random person. I think that picking businesses is incredibly, incredibly difficult. It's like hiring people.
Mm.
Hiring people is incredibly difficult. The people that interview well often turn out to be fantasists, nutcases, or just inept. And the people who interview badly often later on turn out to be really good.
Yeah.
Just not good at being interviewed, right? And it's the same with businesses. You can get great presentations. You can have great ideas. Just doesn't work.
Yes.
And you can have stuff where you think, well, that seems a bit far-fetched. I'm not sure about that guy. I'm not sure how he gets on with the other person. And then it flies. So what I seek to do is just get someone else to do it. And what I do is I work with businesses that get approached by lots of companies for money. So there are venture capital companies in London who get many hundreds of companies approaching them
for it.
And they're scrutinizing them all the time. But they're also monitoring them. And they know who's doing well. They know who's progressing. Some of them they've invested in a year previously.
Yes.
And the company's doing really well. And to get to the next level of growth, it needs a bit more money. So sometimes they're saying, well, we'll give you some more, but we want these six investors to put some money into. So I want to join in with that expertise. I don't believe that I'm good, and I don't even believe that any individual at arm's length is very good at picking winners.
So most of the businesses, Andy, you'll invest in, you will invest in as part of a larger fund round.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Got it. And you'll be leveraging the expertise and the knowledge of the VC team, who's perhaps instructing third-party diligence that you can leverage off.
And often they've monitored these companies for years. They might have made a small investment 2 years ago and followed them all the way through. You know, the journey they're on. But even still, I'm not expecting to make 30% a year on all of my investments. I'm expecting across all of them, and many will go bust, to make 15% a year.
Mm.
Plus tax breaks.
Yes.
And the downside is, that sounds great, the downside is your money's locked up for 8 to 10 years.
Yes.
That's the problem.
So, I could talk to you for hours, but sadly we don't have hours, only 1 hour today, Andy. So I've got two questions, if I may.
Okay.
So, at the beginning of the podcast, we talked about the word contentment, and you sort of were quite quick in saying that you aren't content and have never been content. Tell me, what is it now that makes you feel at ease or makes you feel good accepting one is not content? But when do you feel at your best? When do you feel good?
You know what? I'm not a religious, not a very religious person. Sometimes I pray, right? So sometimes I will get up and I've got a little routine, and I guess I clean my teeth first thing. I do some press ups. I take my vitamins, strong multivitamin. I'll sometimes then pray, and then sometimes I've got to do a really quick walk, yep. Like literally. 14 minutes, 1.3 miles. I do that to get my heart going. And then I'll come back and do a tiny bit of meditation.
Wow.
And
that's, is that every day?
I try to do it every day, but wow. I often can't.
Yes.
But I try to. If I do that, when I've done that, I feel good. I wouldn't say all of the restlessness has gone, and I wouldn't say my drive has gone.
Mm. Mm.
But I've got inner strength. I don't know if I'd call it contentment, but I have an inner something which makes me a little bit less anxious, a bit more focused.
A bit more, right, I'll go and do that. Mm. Instead of me thinking, oh my word, I haven't done that. I need to do it. I'm thinking, I need to do that now. I'll do it. Then I'll move over this. Then I'll do that. Yeah. And there's a, yeah, I'm describing something. It's not contentment, but I'm describing something that is focused, resilient, relatively calm.
Yes.
Does that make sense?
It does. It does.
And see, I think of contentment as sat in an armchair thinking, oh, yeah, yeah, everything's great. I don't have to do anything. Life's good. Don't need to achieve anything. I see contentment as that.
Yes.
Almost a resignation.
Yes. I could not see that either. The way you view the word.
Yeah.
That's right. And of course, contentment is happy.
Yeah.
And I think being happy is important. Otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah. If contentment is happiness, then we should all aspire to have contentment.
Yes, we should. Yeah.
I'll never have it.
No.
But yeah.
No, I respect that. I respect that. And let me ask, so you mentioned your morning routine there, Andy, which involves prayer, meditation, exercise. What do you think specifically you get out of prayer and meditation that gives you that ability to be at peace or feel calm? What specifically do you achieve from that?
I think there's something in... I think everybody has an ego, and I think our egos at times can mean that we think mainly about ourselves. I think that's quite normal, and it might be quite healthy.
Mm-hmm.
I think most people think about themselves, and they're a lot most of the time. But I think that some meditation, some prayer, even going to church, I went to my local church, and I walked outside and chatted with a neighbor, a farmer, and he's not a very religious guy, but he likes to go to church. And he said he likes to go to church because being in this building that's 400 years old, with the gravestones outside where his father went and where he'll be buried, gives him a sense that there's something much bigger and much more permanent.
Yep.
And I think that in a different way, but with it's similar in some ways, meditation and prayer can take away that self-absorption, that focus on me and my life, me and my worries, to think about bigger things.
Yes.
Bigger situation.
Yes.
The fact you're a tourist here. You come and go.
Yes.
Your time is fleeting.
That's right.
And that's what I get from it.
Yes. I think that's really interesting because, as you say, everything's relative. And I think that if you've had a tough day in the office or an argument with your wife or the kids haven't done, you know, what they needed to do before going to school, you can be at that moment highly frustrated, very angry. And actually, you can be quite irrational.
Yeah.
Because, of course, in relative terms, none of that matters.
No.
And of course, when you are in a graveyard looking at thousands of headstones of people who've died, and you're going to be in the ground at some point in the future, if that doesn't level you, nothing
goes. Absolutely right.
So I can see why that is a very humbling, very controlled way of actually giving you a punch in the face and reminding you of how relative your life is. Mm-hmm.
There's a funny line from a film actually about capitalism,
yes,
and graveyards and death and whatever else. And Danny DeVito, who I think is one of the best actors,
legendary, absolutely.
He plays this corporate raider, and he's basically trying to buy this steelworks out in Pittsburgh or somewhere, owned by the same family forever. And he's gonna buy it and break it up, and close it down and raid the pension fund. But he's saying he isn't, but they know he is, and they're trying to save it and fight him off. He's like, why are you doing this? Why do you want to do this? You've got enough money. He said, well, that's the game. What's the game? The game is capitalism. And what's the rules of the game? He goes, simple. Whoever dies with the most money wins. And that's like what you need to remember, right? Whoever dies with the most money doesn't win. It's probably whoever dies with the least money.
That's right.
You might have acquired it and give it away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whoever dies with more, and that's how most people are heading, I think, very often, isn't it?
Yep.
Trying to die with as much money as possible.
I think that's right. I think that's right. And I'll not get into politics, nor will I get into my views on taxation. But for sure, I think the only thing that's encouraging people now to perhaps think about whether dying with a significant amount of wealth is the right thing is taxation and IHT and business property relief. Because actually now, perhaps the right thing to do is to give it away.
Yeah.
But again, that's my old, my old approach and view on the same subject. Andy, my last question for today is a very personal one. Obviously, you talked right at the beginning of the podcast about losing your brother recently, which of course is devastating. What is the one thing that you would love to be able to do with him that you didn't get the chance to do before he passed?
Gosh, really hard not to be really emotional here. So I'm going to try hard not to be too emotional. I would say that I would want him to know that he was supported. My brother Johnny, it was 4 years ago now, and he was in some ways a very troubled soul, and he had a tough time for many years, and the family were very supportive in their own way, but I don't think he felt very supported, and I think in times the tensions between himself and other members of the family or the whole family meant that he'd be isolated. And he had a tough time, a tough life. Try hard not to be too emotional. But I'm full of regret for not doing more, for not giving more of a... being more obvious in my support, being more clear. I did support, but I if I had my time again, I would push harder with support, even though he said he didn't want it very often. But I think he did.
Yes.
And I think that sometimes it was easier for me to accept the fact that he said, I don't want it, and not get involved. You know, because I wanted a simple life myself. I think what I've offered, but I knew sometimes that he did want it. And I regret that. I really regret that.
No, I respect that. And of course, it's devastating news. I think the point you've made, though, which is something that is important to me, and I'm sure many of our viewers, is, you know, there will be people who are troubled. There are people who need help. And some of those people know they need help, but are perhaps too proud to seek it.
Yeah.
Some of those people don't know they need help, but it's quite self-evident that they do.
Yeah.
And I think as humans, you know, we all absolutely owe it to other people to support them and to ask questions and to be there and to just be approachable, because sometimes all it is a conversation. Sometimes all it is a coffee or a beer.
Yeah.
Point being, I think we can all do more to be there for people who need help.
Bill Carl, you know what? Because there are different personalities. So there are some people, and every time they get a bit disappointed or frustrated, they put it on Facebook.
That's right.
Or life's so cruel, or you can't trust anyone. And everyone's like, oh, are you okay, hon? And they're trying to sucker in some support for some minor issue.
Yes.
But yet there are other people suffering huge things, and it's very hard to find the right balance.
Yes, I agree. I agree.
Tell people to seek support and help, because some people use that as a platform. Some people are sympathy junkies.
That's right.
And they use that as a platform. It's very difficult. And I sometimes think that our approach to mental health and support for mental health, which is probably overall brilliant, I think it causes lots of trouble as well. I think it causes lots of problems. There's a bit of a cult of mental health where someone who says, yes, I'm struggling at the moment, I have to
admit,
everyone says, oh, you're so brave, well done.
Yep.
And I'm not sure that actually does society and the people a lot of good, because I suspect very often the people who say they're struggling aren't the ones that are really, really struggling.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to find a way of reaching the people who are desperate.
Yep.
I'm not being very articulate here.
No, you are.
What I'm trying to say is that it seems to me that our increased awareness of mental health and our increased and rightful desire to help people with mental health challenges might be making the overall mental health picture worse. That's what I'm trying to say.
Yes, and I agree with you.
Yeah.
I think that now it seems highly common that people talk about mental health and their troubles with mental health. Mm-hmm. And of course, I'm not saying for a moment that the said individual may not have depression, may not have negative thoughts, may not be struggling. Mm-hmm. But whether that's mental health or
yes,
them choosing to see the negative is different.
Yeah, absolutely.
And as you say, Andy, I'm afraid that some people who talk about their daily struggle are seeking sympathy.
Yes.
Want someone to make their life easier for them.
Yeah.
And sometimes the people who are struggling, struggle alone. In silence. So I think you're right. You cannot judge every book by a cover.
People aren't struggling very much, but like to share the fact that they're feeling a bit down. Yes. The more attention they get, yes, the more it becomes their identity.
That's right.
And it can make it much worse.
It can.
Much worse.
It can.
Look, mental health problems are real. There are people with real challenges, but sometimes I think that focusing on it really hard can do more harm than good. And what we all need to do is seek help if we're desperate, but be busy. Go to work, take exercise, meet with people where you can. That's the way to live a happier life.
I agree. Andy, it has been an absolute pleasure to have you on my podcast. And can I perhaps be the first person to wish you and your family a very Merry Christmas? It's been an absolute pleasure having Andy Preston on my Confessions of an Entrepreneur podcast today. It was really interesting to hear more about Andy's upbringing here in the Northeast, and of course, understanding that as someone who never seems to fit with conformity and never likes to work within boundaries, school, of course, understandably wasn't for him. Leaving school without any qualification, Andy quickly found himself joining the RAF, which is perhaps where he learned that sometimes structure, discipline, and working within boundaries is actually for your own benefit. Of course, after the RAF, Andy decided to pursue an academic qualification, which of course is why he decided to go to Edinburgh University to get a degree before becoming a very, very successful, highly acclaimed, highly notable hedge fund manager. Andy spent many years working in London, traveling internationally as a very successful hedge fund manager before deciding on the back of the financial crisis to pause and spend more time back in the Northeast, not only doing the things he enjoys, which of course absolutely includes supporting his family, but also supporting local businesses and local charities. Since then, Andy has dedicated such a significant amount of his life supporting local charities and setting up two significant charities, including the Teesside Foundation, which of course is all about raising money for local charities who help people day to day better their lives and to give them a more significant platform to live a wholesome, content and successful life. Andy, I thank you, as do I'm sure all of our viewers, for all of the phenomenal work you have done and continue to do for charities here in the Northeast and further afield. Obviously, on the podcast, Andy did talk a little bit about the passing of his brother only 4 years ago, which, of course, whilst devastating, perhaps has inspired Andy and I'm sure his broader family as they start to understand the relativity of life and the fact that we are all here for a short time. And therefore, perhaps that does tell us a little bit about what drives Andy, because from a very young age, he's always wanted to achieve as much as possible in the shortest possible time frame, taking no one or nothing for granted. And whilst, of course, his brother only passed 4 years ago, I do think that Andy's absolute zest for life and hunger to make the most of the opportunity ahead of him is something perhaps us all could take some benefit from. I think the final thing I'll take away from the podcast today was Andy's openness around the fact that whilst he has achieved success in and out of business, actually he does so not in a prescriptive way. He doesn't overthink things. And actually, what he seems to have done very successfully is put himself in the right place at the right time, often enough. And by surprise, perhaps, his good fortune seems to be something that has been consistent throughout his life. It has been brilliant to spend some time with Andy, who can only be described as a very charismatic, energetic, can-do guy who wants to make the most of the opportunity given to him. And therefore, for sure, I hope there is a lot that each of our viewers can take away from the podcast today.
You have been watching Confessions of an Entrepreneur. This is our last podcast for 2025. And of course, you can download this or any other podcast from our series from wherever you download your podcasts from. But for now, I'd love to thank you, our viewers, for joining us this year on all of our Confessions of an Entrepreneur podcasts. I wish you and your family a very merry, very warm, and very enjoyable Christmas. Please enjoy your time out and try and perhaps reflect on your successes and plan for what will only be, I'm sure, a prosperous 2026. But for now, thanks again. Merry Christmas, and we look forward to seeing you on future Confessions of an Entrepreneur podcast.